Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 31st. See Home Club for details.
Welcome to another BitFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Sasha Coward. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today, Stuart.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Now, you are a researcher, historian, and public speaker. You've worked in museums and heritage for, 15 years, running tours on LGBTQ history for museums, cemeteries, archives, and cities all around the world.
I'm also an escape room designer, which is like a really strange thing that doesn't seem to mesh with all of that. But that's hopefully what we're going to talk about a bit today.
But we are here today to talk about what is your first book, Queer as Folklore. So congratulations on that achievement, for starters.
Thank you very much. I am delighted and terrified in equal amounts. But yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
So before we get into some of the details of that book, do you want to give the listener a sort of brief synopsis as to what Queer as Folklore is as a book?
As you said, I've been working in museums for a long time, and I'm really interested in old stuff in history, but particularly the stories that fall through the cracks. So those about the kinds of people which we've only recently, as a society, been focusing on. And as a gay man myself, I'm really interested in the stories of lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people in the past. Mm-hmm. I'm also a massive nerd, and I've been into mythology, monsters, folklore, all of that, fantasy, you name it. I'm a D&D player. I'm a video game fan. You can pretty much tick all the boxes just by hearing that. And I am really fascinated about how those apply to my community. Mm. Because if you go to a gay pride parade anywhere in the world, like obviously you'll see tank tops and tiaras, and you'll see Doc Martens, and you'll see purple hair, and you'll see rainbow flags, but you'll also see unicorns and fairy wings and t-shirts with werewolves on and cat ears and drag queens dressed as mermaids. So what's that all about? And as a historian looking at this, just as my own like personal private little fascination, I used to work at the National Maritime Museum in London, which is one of the few places where you can say you see mermaids during your day job and people don't think you've been taking illicit substances. And getting into that folklore, but seeing it through the lens of my own community, why are we so connected to those? And it's not just that they're sparkly and fabulous. There's this really rich vein of history that connects us back to these mythical creatures and monsters, arguably going back hundreds and thousands of years. And then I was lucky enough to get an agent who basically said, that sounds like a book. And I love a pun, so Queer as Folklore sort of spun off from that. And I've been gently losing my mind for the past 2 years, and a book came out of it. So that's pretty much where Queer as Folklore came from.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, in your introduction to the book, you define what folklore is, and you differentiate between the word folk and the word lore, and you also you sort of tell us that what we know already, that folklore is this ancient thing, this oral tradition, but you also then go on to say what I'm going to do with this book is also introduce video games, movies, mm-hmm. pop culture. Mm-hmm. And the like, and even I didn't even realize till reading your book that even sort of stuff that's recorded generally is considered with a no-no in folklore world. So What made you want to introduce those elements to a book about folklore? And why is it for the layperson, why is that controversial?
Because, it is. And it probably shouldn't be. But there's this very academic understanding of folklore, which is often that it has to be like an oral tradition, which means that it's spoken by word of mouth and not written down. And for me, that seems just a little bit random. Like, why is storytelling only important in that way if it's not written down? It is really interesting, those stories that are told by word of mouth. But it kind of puts this weird hierarchy, the idea that modern ways of art and storytelling, like video games, film, even photography, are somehow seen as less valuable as historical records than a beautiful ancient Greek vase in the British Museum. And my argument is, well, they're both receptacles of storytelling. You know, that vase tells me something about the culture, the stories that people were interested in. But that film tells me the same thing as well, just about today. And you can guarantee that in 100, 200 years, those things that we see as modern pop culture will be seen as historical, old, dusty folklore. So why not skip all of that silliness and let's just treat it all as equal? Because from my perspective, it's all equally interesting in terms of understanding about gender and sexuality. And I guess on the flip side to that, there is this sense that, so towards the end of the book, I talk about aliens, I talk about superheroes and robots, which you might not expect when you know, we do fairies and unicorns and mermaids, but those kind of modern sci-fi concepts may not be perceived as folklore. But I guess as a queer person, for the longest period of time, we've not been seen as part of human history. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans people have been seen as this weird modern aberration, which is, you know, it's absolute BS. We've been around, we're part of the human experience as long as humans have been around. Yeah. And the same way that, why are we treating this modern folklore as being less important or less interesting? So I guess, I went into the writing this going, I want this to feel, it sounds really pretentious, apologies, but kind of radical. Like, that's, shake it up and not just do the really old stuff. We will do the really old stuff, but let's bring it all the way into the present, partly to make it feel more relevant. So yeah, that was always a goal of mine.
Yeah. And certainly, and it was a neat trick you did with, and I'm not sure it was a trick, but when I was reading it, it felt like a really neat trick where you start off talking about David Bowie and as a way of introducing us to the idea of the alien and folklore. And then you end on Herland, the book by Charlotte Perkins, I think it was, and telling us that one of the, you know, a book written, that's a text that survived from Roman times, is talking about same-sex relationships. And it was sort of amazing to think, you know, at first you're going, this is a bit frowned upon in terms of discussing folklore. And then we go, actually, no. Is that well known, or is that a text you found and then that sort of became something you were able to form that particular part of your thesis around?
Well, I mean, if I'm honest, I would love for your listeners to have this image of me as being a sort of gay Indiana Jones. We'll get to that in a bit. Going into the archives, discovering, you know, for the first time, ancient history, blowing the dust of these old manuscripts. The fact is that that isn't how a lot of historical research happens. All of these texts, pretty much all of the ones that I refer to, have been studied by many people from many different angles already.
Yeah.
Not necessarily all from an LGBTQ plus angle, but yeah, they're mostly known texts, sometimes maybe less seen from an LGBT perspective. But in the Aliens chapter, for example, the piece of writing by Lucien of Samosata, which is called A True Story, and it's argued to be one of the very first examples of, quote, science fiction. You get into very woolly ground there. What is science fiction? But it has aliens in it, and it's ancient. No, it's a classical text, and it has aliens in it. They're nothing like little green men that we have today. David Bowie wouldn't recognize them, that's for sure. But they are creatures from another world. And I think that they've been looked at a lot. This story's been looked at a lot as a first piece of science fiction. it's been looked at a lot as being a bit like Gulliver's Travels, because it's like this, it's called True Story, ironically. It's like someone saying, look at this insane story that couldn't possibly have happened. But no one, as far as I can gather, has gone, wait, these are the first aliens that we kind of know on in the European or Western tradition, and they're all gay. Does this mean something?
Yeah.
So I guess it wasn't, people have laughed at these gay aliens because it's quite a funny scene. They all give birth through the leg. They've never heard of women before. But no one's gone, does this mean something about aliens? People have more kind of gone, does this tell us something about Lucian? Or is this, you know, but this was lining it up in the very first aliens example that we have in ancient history. They're gay. Why were they gay? And why do aliens today have this subversive sexuality around them, or at least some of them? And I think that's kind of, what I was getting at.
And it's always nice to have some crossover between past guests that I've had on my podcast when I speak to, when new people come on. And I was delighted to see at the start of the Unicorns chapter, you quoting Amru Al-Qadi, who was on recently talking about his debut feature film, Layla. That was quite eye-opening for me in terms of like the origins of the unicorn and then how it features in queer culture. I hadn't thought about that at all. And you mentioned it, I don't think it's because I'm not part of the gay community at all, but I think I hadn't really made that connection. And I think that's something that's a recurring thing in your book, that idea of identity and identifying, and where identity is not, for want of a better expression, not other in here, but it's like the idea of. But then I did a podcast with a writer called Gareth Dimlow, and we did queer themes in modern horror, and he talked to me about watching Interview with a Vampire, and for the first time he could sit in an audience and, for want of a better expression, just perv over men in cinema, and he'd not had that, and it wasn't illicit. It was like being presented to him as a mainstream thing. So I don't know what my question is there in that sense. It's more of an observation. Hopefully it makes some sense and it relates to what you were trying to do with your book.
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point there, because to be clear, like I've been gay since I knew what the word gay meant and was able to apply it to myself. I was a gay kid even before I knew I was gay. And I knew that the unicorn was associated with my community, but I didn't know anything about why. You said you weren't sure about the connection. I wasn't sure about the connection until I started looking into it. I guess that, why do gay men get called fairies? Probably because they're a bit, feminine. Mm. But there's more to it. And so it's weird that even within the community, we have all these received symbols and icons that we don't all fully understand. So when I was quoting the book, which is, I think, My Life as a Unicorn,
right,
is the title, it was more so I could say, look, this is something that we sort of, as a community, we kind of get. We like unicorns. We dress up as them. We use the symbol. Let's now go from the present, someone who's telling their identification with it, and see if we can find a story that goes back into the past. And that's kind of a structure for a lot of the chapters. Mm. Like David Bowie, all right, he's this camp, kind of metrosexual, gender-bending, androgynous, hard-to-pin-down character, and he uses aliens. Now let's go to ancient Greece. So that's what I've been trying to do throughout the book, use both of those examples to bounce off each other.
Brilliant. Now, a question I often ask people who've made documentaries, and I think it applies to books like this, where you go in, you have to go in with a sort of received wisdom and a clear idea of what you're trying to do. But then obviously there's the journey. When you've got your Indiana Jones hat on and you are going through the archives, what for you was the kind of most surprising discovery in terms of what you perceive going into this project and what you now understand having written the book?
I think one of the things that was really surprising to me was how ubiquitous all over the world, there are so many different cultures and religions and peoples. And if you go throughout history, we've changed so much, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea, I'm going to paint with really broad brushstrokes, that like magic as a very broad concept and gender bending in any form that you can imagine those two things just seem to go together over and over again. So, for example, in Native American cultures, like the Zuni people, the Lahamana, who would often be known as two-spirit or a third gender person, so someone who might be assigned female at birth, and it's not the same as transgender, but would sort of take on a role that would mix masculine and feminine roles, would be responsible for magic, for prayer, for healing. But then you go to ancient Mesopotamia and you find, you know, so-called eunuch priests practicing this. You see it in ancient Rome. You see it in India with the Hijra. You see this kind of cropping up over and over and over again. And then I started to think about, like, okay, so if we think about medieval England, where magic would often be seen as quite sinful against the Bible, but you have got, like, in its own sense, this kind of pantheon of saints, and you have nuns and you have priests. What's the dress of nuns and priests? It's androgyny. You hide your hair, you cover yourself in long robes, you either step away from sex, or, as we know about monasteries and those things historically, there is all kinds of sex happening there. Yeah. So it's like, around the world, gender bending and non-heterosexual sexuality has this powerful link to the idea of magic, which, once I'd written the book, I was like, it seems so clear. And yet I still don't know why.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that little insight into the into your book, Queer as Folklore. We're now going to move into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Right, three films, Tasha. You've given me three film titles, which we're going to talk for the subtotal of 5 minutes, or maybe a little bit longer if you need to finish a thought. And every time 5 minutes are up, we will hear this sound. Without further ado, we'll start with your first movie, which is, I didn't know this because this is urban myth to me, the idea of Jaws in space. This was a note from a reader that read the script for the studio, which was a big revelation for me. The original cut of the movie ran to 3.5 hours. The original title was Star Beast. And I am indeed talking about Ridley Scott's 1979 movie, Alien. Now, do you want to tell us where this fits in, your movie watching life, and why it had such an impact on you?
So I saw this film when I was far too young. I was 7. And I was obsessed with the VHS cover. It sat on my parents' video bookshelf, and I was told I wasn't allowed to watch it until I nagged my dad enough that he basically put it on for me when I was far too young. The nightmares that I had, to this day, when I have a nightmare, it's still informed by Alien. So I can tell a dream's going off the rails when things start dripping from the ceiling and there's like hissing noises and it all starts to get a bit gross and organic. Like that's how much it affected me. Despite the fact that I was terrified of it, it is my favorite film of all time. I think it is the perfect film. I think it is almost without flaw. I think it's so good, so creepy, so terrifying, even though it was made so long ago. And the reason for that is because the way it uses like psychosexual imagery. So it's not just scary monsters.
Yeah.
It's scary monsters that like are not sexy, but use reproduction, that turn the whole concept of reproduction and sex on its head. Mm-hmm. The creatures look like a weird hermaphroditic combination of different things. The design is wonderful, and it's thanks to Alien that I'm obsessed with horror films, that I love science fiction. I love being scared. I've grown to love that sensation. And I've analyzed that film to death. It's in the book from every perspective possible. And I think it started my fascination with analysis and seeing that something like a horror film can have these wonderful layers to it. And I think it says a lot about human fears.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Around gender and sexuality. On the surface, scary horror film, Jaws in space, acid for blood, big scary chest bursters. On a deeper level, there's so much going on. And I watch this film probably at least two or three times a year. I love it so much.
So tell for the audience then, tell us some of those other layers that are below the surface of a scary movie that you now see in that movie that obviously a seven-year-old wouldn't have seen.
So like the main kind of big thing is it's the breakout film for Sigourney Weaver. Mm-hmm. She is in some ways the very first female action hero. Arguably, there might be some others, but she's kind of the big one that properly takes that role.
Yeah.
The character of Ripley that she plays was originally written to be either unisex or to be played by a man. But they didn't really rewrite the character. They simply brought Sigourney in, keeping this strong character of someone who knows what they're doing. Mm. And if you can imagine this film being made in 1979, if it had been rewritten with an actress in mind, they probably would have tried to have watered it down. Mm. And they would have lost some of what makes Ripley a really great character. So it was this, she's a gender-bending character. She's a woman playing a male role that comes together beautifully. In terms of the creature, it gestates inside a human host. The very first person it takes over, spoilers, mm-hmm. Is a man, and he gives birth to it. So it is this idea of what is the greatest fear for a man? Well, it is the idea of forced penetration and then having to go through childbirth, something that would normally not be associated with men. So the horror of it is about taking sexuality and twisting it on its head. And the design of the alien, which is inspired by the work of the very disturbing artist, gothic artist Geiger, it has a head, let's be really honest, like a phallus, like mm-hmm. it has this huge phallic head. But then a mouth that opens up and is kind of, again, it's vaginal. It's this combination of different genitalia mixed together, which makes it so frightening. It's beautiful and elegant. In fact, largely, it's the performers inside the costume of the alien are dancers and acrobats. So it had this dancerly feminine movement that contrasts with its violent predatory nature. The colors, the symbolism, the music, it's the fact that the computer system is called Mother. It's all about subverting gender.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you for sharing that. If I could be so crude on the end of your very serious points you made, they literally use KY jelly as the effect that we see for the sliminess, which is like if you didn't see under the surface, then it was there looking it in the face.
The lead performer for the alien who was covered in that KY jelly was hired from a bar in Soho.
Indeed.
So there's so much fun going on there that you can drill into.
Moving swiftly along to your second choice, this is 1981's biggest grossing film by a wide margin. In 1999, it was added to the National Film Registry by the United States Library of Congress. The hero's iconic hat came from a famous Herbert Johnson hat shop in Savile Row, which I'm so glad I know that fact now. I am indeed talking about Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, Steven Spielberg and Loris Kasdan, starring, obviously, Harrison Ford in the titular role. Where does this film feature in your film-watching life, and why did it have such an impact on you?
To be honest, about the same age that I was watching Alien, I was watching the Indiana Jones series, all three films. Mm-hmm. I was completely taken by the character because I'm a nerdy boy that likes history and museums, and I a very particular way. You know, this was you would never be an action hero that was into archaeology, right? So having this character of Indy was something I really identify with because he was cool, but he was also really smart. And so I was really taken by him. Now, I will add, as a young gay man, I was also completely infatuated with him. So that was the added level that I thought he was really cute. Mm-hmm. But it was this element of, like, there's a great scene that he says it in a number of the films where he says, it belongs in the museum. That's like one of his taglines. And like, how can you take such a nerdy archetype and turn it into an action hero? And in my own way, I feel like I've sort of subconsciously tried and probably failed to model myself on Indiana Jones. The fact is, you can't really behave like that and jump into a museum with a whip and, you know, smash things and steal things from temples without permission. But that energy is something that carried its way through into me wanting to continue doing the work that I do. Hmm. And also, the fact that all of the films are full of puzzles. So it's all about the temple. You have to balance the right thing to make sure that the trap doesn't go off. Or in the final film, you have to go through all of these riddles to try to get to the, you know, the cup that held the blood of Christ, or find the hidden Roman numeral. I feel like that all filtered through. And it's one of the reasons why I love puzzles and why I got into escape rooms. And so if I was going to try to marry my two selves, which are the nerdy historian, right, but also the puzzle obsessive adventurer, this is where they come together. And I don't think I knew it when I was seven and watching this, but there was something clicking into place that was like, I want to be like him. Now, thankfully, I'm not Indiana Jones entirely. As cool as he is, he wouldn't function very well in real life 2025. But like, parts of that character are still something that I find really compelling and cool.
Yeah, until you said it, I hadn't really thought about the for an action hero, there are lots of elements in the series which are about brain, not brawn. You know, the getting out of a sticky situation wasn't to do with how tough you were, but how clever you were.
Yeah. So he is tough and he can shoot a gun and, you know, and all of that. But the drive is normally about an artifact. It's about trying to find something, reclaim something. And a lot of the stuff he's doing, he's often at like a school lecturing. He's got like books with notes. He's well-read. He can count in Greek, like all of this stuff. As a nerdy boy who was a bit embarrassed about how nerdy I was, this was a character where I could go, oh, you know, I couldn't identify with Superman. I couldn't identify with any of those other, you know, just alpha male characters. Mm. But Indy, there was more going on and I could connect with that. Nowadays, I think that archetype is a bit more broad. We've got like Tomb Raider, that, you know, there's the whole Sherlock Holmes concept. But I'd say back then when I was watching this in the 90s, action heroes were big and dumb, and nerds were, you know, reading books and they were the butt of the joke. And this was a character that combined them both. I'm not saying it's like, you know, a masterpiece of beautiful, clever cinema. It's good, fun popcorn film. But there was something about that I can see resonates with the kind of character I wanted to be when I was a kid.
But of the series, you were saying before we started recording that Last Crusade is in fact your favourite of the series. So why, getting the chance to watch all three back to back, which I guess is what you're saying, we may never know. The bell is ringing.
The time is up.
We're left hanging. I tell you what, we'll just squeeze some extra time in. Do you want to tell us what? I've been having the advantage of watching them all back to back. Is that your first view? Is to see them all as a series?
Yeah, I mean, we had them taped off the TV.
Okay.
Right. So this is classic kind of time. Temple of Doom, I'll be honest, it's not my fave. I don't think it's dated very well. Mm-hmm. I actually find it a little bit dull. Mm-hmm. You can fight me on that, but that's what I believe. You know, Raiders of the Lost Ark is the first, so it's the classic, right? Mm-hmm. But Last Crusade has got like the Da Vinci Code level puzzles in it. You know, it's got that great scene with the rotating fireplace and the Nazis that just always cracks me up. And I think it's got a bit more heart to it.
Right.
And it's also got some really cool puzzles. So that's why it's my favorite.
Moving swiftly along to your final choice of your three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. The owl in the title sequence of this movie was the first attempt at CGI. In a feature film, which was a pleasant surprise to learn. Now, we've mentioned the guy already who is the star, who's one of the stars of this film, but I didn't know this. Michael Jackson, Prince, Mick Jagger were all considered to play the Goblin King. Big clue, listeners. Jim Henson wanted Sting, God forbid. But thankfully, his kids said, you should get David Bowie. And that's how we got David Bowie in the role of Jareth, the Goblin King, in Labyrinth from 1986. So tell us, how does this film have an impact on you?
Again, they're all around the same age. So Perfect. We're talking like 7 or 8, and I'm aging myself a little bit. This would be a Blockbuster Video. So every Friday, to be fair, we wouldn't go to Blockbuster Videos. We'd go to the off-brand version that was called Video Nights with okay. a K. In Camden Town in London.
I had Video Time, yeah. It was my local video shop.
You know, the classic. So it was like cheaper Blockbuster. And I would get the same couple of films out every single time, which seems so weird, but you couldn't go onto like Netflix and just play it. So I would get the same VHS. I don't know why we never bought it. And Labyrinth, I probably watched it about 40 times in my childhood. I was obsessed with that film. And for a number of reasons, it was creepy. Mm. Like it's fun. It's still a family film, but it is so creepy. The scene where she is like making the promise. So at the very beginning, she says that she wants to give her little brother away to the Goblin Prince. Yeah. And they're all the goblins are hiding in the cracks of her wardrobe. Like she's going to say the magic words. And it's so sinister. Mm. And then there's a bit where she goes back to what she thinks is her real house. And there's this horrible, gnarled woman taking all her things and like handing it to her. So despite being a family film, it has this layer of sinisterness that I really enjoyed. But the design of the puppets and the world is so clearly drawn from like European folklore, from German fairy tales, the original fairies. Not the pretty Disney ones, the ones the Victorians did a hatchet job on, but the gnarled, ugly. In fact, there's a great scene at the beginning where Hoggle kills a fairy because they're basically like pests. And everything about it is so bizarre and like a fever dream, but in a way that totally captured my imagination. But guess what? We've got puzzles again. You've got like the two knights, right, that ask you... No, one of us always lies and one of us always tells the truth. You have to solve the riddle. You've got things where you've got to navigate through the labyrinth. All of this stuff going on, M.C. Escher style situations. And something about that slotted into my brain. The creepy fantasy of it, the dark fantasy, which I've always been drawn to over cutesy Disney. And the fact that like it's got these puzzles. And then, of course, there's David Bowie just chewing the furniture in the role of Jared. And I won't say, I don't think I ever had a crush on him, but I think I was drawn to him. Like, who is this androgynous, powerful, gender-bending weirdo? Like, what a character.
Yeah.
Not your classic protagonist. And then, like, as I was saying, David Bowie, it's no coincidence that he loves playing alien-like characters and then was cast as basically a king of goblins or fairies, bringing that same character to it. Because folklore, whether it's ultra-old or ultra-modern, it has this wonderful space for gender bending, which I think Labyrinth has, like, it puts on display. It's such a fun film. It's a film I can watch and never get bored of. I always, you know, to this day, I will stick it on. It's probably another film I'll watch pretty much every single year. I can pretty much quote along the characters as they go. But I thought it was a marrying of fairy tales and fantasy and folklore with puzzles and then a little twist of David Bowie's sexuality in there just for a bit of spice on top.
It's fascinating. Everybody I speak to about Labyrinth, when they talk about it, it's spoken with such affection and love for the film. And yet in 1986, the film couldn't get arrested in the box office and sadly became Jim Henson's last feature film. But thanks to, what was your video shop called again?
Video Nights.
So thanks to the likes of Video Nights and obviously Blockbuster, Home Entertainment got, you know, found Labyrinth a home, as it were, for its for its audience that couldn't find it when it was in the cinema, because now it's sort of considered sort of almost like canon as far as sort of fantasy go, you know. And I think it's the same. I mean, there's a, weirdly, it was being shot alongside it. Ridley Scott's Legend, I think, had a similar had a similar journey. And it may speak to probably, I'm not, I don't think it's, I don't think it's writ large, but it may speak to some of the things you talk about in your book about maybe what was maybe the weirdness that would be putting off, sort of would be putting off people would be, is the idea of how folklore and fairy tale really works.
Yeah. And like, it is fascinating to me that it bombed at, in the box office because I was so obsessed with it. But the whole character arc of the main character is that she's trying to escape from her humdrum life. So again, I think there was something about a little boy, me, who knew he was a bit different, really associating with the bratty male female character and kind of going, yeah, I would love to escape as well. So yeah, it's amazing that it's so popular now, isn't it? It really still resonates with people today.
But it's a common thing for films to talk about. The other one is The Thing, John Carpenter's movie, a very different movie, but one that bombed completely, and then it found an audience that means that it's, you know, it's considered a classic. You know, Labyrinth is a classic. You, like you say, David Bowie chewing the furniture up in 1986 wasn't palatable to people. They're going, oh, he's not taking himself serious enough. He's not, you know. And then he can look back, as he probably did, think, I can, this, I'll just enjoy myself. No, I mean, the idea that everyone has precise steps in their creative careers, and the idea that David Bowie's going, do you know what? I can probably just enjoy this.
Yeah. I don't think he had to try very hard to play that character.
No.
This is why when you said that, you know, I think I'd heard this before, that Sting could have been chosen by Jim Henson. Can you imagine how awful that would have been?
It just would have, it would have been devoid of almost all of what makes the film magical, I think. It would have been too try hard, I think, in the end.
Yeah.
Well, look, that brings us to the end of three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Thank you very much for sharing those stories. And thank you very much for introducing us to your first book, hopefully not your last, Queer as Folklore.
It is in all reputable bookshops. You can find it everywhere and anywhere. And if you're struggling with money, you can get it from a library, and or you can wait till it comes out in paperback in May. It's also got an audio book too. There you go. I'm trying to do my marketing thing. I'm getting used to it.
Are you reading the audio book?
I am not, because this is a funny story. It's a proper skill set, right?
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
And they asked for a recording of my voice doing a bit of the text. And they were like, no, we're sure you do talks and things. I sent it off and they were like, yeah, we've gone with someone else.
Really?
Which, I will be honest, he has an amazing voice. He's a gay guy, because the one stipulation was it has to be read by someone from the community.
Yeah.
And he's like, really looked into the pronunciation of all the words, and he reads it so much better than I would. It isn't me, it's better.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much for giving us your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you, Stuart. Cheers, that was a blast.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.